think we're just going to get right back to it. Sean, I think you were going to start off with some questions.
Let's see, which I think some of these questions have already been answered. One question is that, so for both of you guys, and this, like, were reverbs something that you were passionate about before you joined Lexicon Alesis, or did it just, is that something that you got interested in, like, once you were on the job? And I know.
Well, yeah, well, I personally started off playing guitar and had an old Fender with spring reverb in it. And I, very, very mild. There's a little tiny splash of it. It actually sounds kind of nice. And if you kick it, it sounds like a space alien kind of shooting laser beams at you. So that was my first experience with reverbs. But when I was my first audio gig, I got a company, Quad 8 Westrex, and they made a digital reverb.
What was the company again?
Quad 8.
Oh, yeah.
Quad 8 Westrex. And they made a very funny reverb that I guess some notoriety, but big, massive 3RU, weighed a ton, had a big linear supply in there and a bunch of boards, sold for about $5,000 or $4,000 or something. And I didn't work on that product at all. I was more on the big mixing consoles they had. But the thing that was neat about it is I thought it was fun to play with. I couldn't afford it, so I went out to Radio Shack. This must have been 83, 84, and they had a little reverb for like $49, and used the Radicon SAD 1040, I think, a Bucket Brigade, which was it had a sampler, but it wasn't quantized. You just basically would just shift all these charges down, and you would get a delay effect in a couple of hundred milliseconds, I think. And it was noisy as heck and low bandwidth, but it was fun to play with. So, I mean, I've always been a audio gadget guy, and that was my experience with reverb. And then, of course, I was a big Jeff Beck fan. I wanted to emulate Jeff Beck, and even bought a white Strat at one time. And you look at Guitar Player magazine and say, what's his gear? What does he play? And he played like a TS9 and a Digitech digital reverb, digital delay. So, of course, I went out and bought it. Still have them, but I don't sound anything like Jeff Beck. But, so that was that. And then, over the years, a lot of effects, a lot of various effects. It's kind of an addiction. You've got to be careful.
So, I was passionate about reverb because I thought it was a perfect usage for digital processing at the time. I wasn't convinced that making recordings with digital for music was a good idea, but I thought the reverb worked pretty well, and I thought that was a great thing to get involved with. So it was a passion when I joined Lexicon for the very reason is that they had gotten Dave Griesinger in there and we're going to build the reverb. And it remained my passion throughout my time at Lexicon. In fact, I actually played with the Radicon parts and built a little recirculating, multi-tap delay line thing one time. Fun little things to play with, yeah. They were interesting, but very limited anyway. But so digital was the way to go. I knew that. And the thing is, what I wanted to use it for is I always thought that two-channel stereo in the home was a little sterile and it needed something. Okay, and that's where I thought I could see reverb going. I said something to augment, home listening. If we could do it properly, and just in some way augment the room, increase the effective size of the room. One of the things I did play with was at the time I had a living room which was quite long, 26 feet long, and I had I had Dayton Wright electrostatics at one end of it. And on the other end of the room were two windows that faced out on an enclosed porch. So I put a couple of Bozak woofers in the windows in panels, okay, and then I drove them from the delay so that they'd be a delayed replica of the, but just the bass of the front channels. And I have to say, it really increased the involvement in the room. The room really seemed to, get bigger and so on because these speakers were, sort of taking that wave and then going and sort of letting the room make the room get bigger. So I really thought there was something to be said with, you know, using digital delay and reverb to enhance the listening experience. But so, in fact, I actually, at the end, we actually took it there. Just as I was leaving Lexicon, we did the CP1 processor. And this was my last push with Lexicon. I wanted to get them into the home theater market. And they went kicking and screaming into that market, believe me. I said, you got to come in under $1,000, okay? But I said, the market is growing like mad. I said, you know, you'll easily, you know, sell tens of thousands of these things, I mean, in a short time. They wouldn't believe it. They just wouldn't believe it. They wouldn't believe it. But we did this CB1. We did a custom chip for this. Dave did some processing. In the early stages when we were playing around with it, the one thing that he did that was pretty impressive is he did the Dolby Pro Logic in digital. And we were always wondering, well, you know, how's that going to go? Because you have to send this to approval. So we sent the unit to Dolby, and they said, well, this is the best implementation we've ever heard of Pro Logic. I mean, it really worked. And we had a couple of favorite things we used for testing it. And one of them was Top Gun on a laser disc, and that had great surround effects. You know, the planes would fly over you, and boy, with a Lexicon, it would just like that right over the top of you, and there was no ambiguity about where the planes were flying. It was really good. So I thought that was one of the great things we did. But unfortunately, I left Lexicon because I could not convince them that there was a real market in home theater and that they should get into it. They were like pro people, and they wanted to do, you know, digital recording, you know, the RD1 and the stuff that came from that. You know, they went and spent 10 years on Opus, $10 million, all down the drain because, well, you know, we did it. Anyway, that's another story. That's a whole different story.
But the CP1, was that kind of like, was it that direction that led to Lexicon being acquired by Harman?
I think eventually, yes, because Lexicon did get that. This is their bridge into the consumer market. But I think Harman would have acquired anyway. I mean, they were in the end of the 90s, they were getting pretty desperate for cash. They were not making any money. Opus was losing money. There were other people that were better equipped to do digital consoles, like Yamaha and those guys who had lots of money to throw at it and didn't care about the return for the next 20 years. You know, Lexicon couldn't afford that. Anyway, I will pass. This is the literature for the 224, the PCM60, the 480L, and the CP1. I'll just pass it around in case anybody wants to look to see. That's what we put out at the time. Yeah, I like them all back, but, you know. Yeah. Anyway, so yes, I was passionate about reverb, and I remain passionate about it, especially when they did the CP1. I thought that was really an important direction to take digital signal processing.
I guess this would be a good time to lead to the next question. It's like, well, one question is that talking about the early days, something that both Barry Blesser was the main algorithm designer behind the EMT250,
right.
And both him and Griesinger have said something interesting is that they both found these articles by Manfred Schroeder. And Manfred Schroeder was this brilliant scientist. I think he worked at Bell Labs. He created, in 1961, 1962, published these papers that laid basically the foundations for digital reverbs, like the building blocks, all pass delays and comb delays. And both Blesser and Griesinger ended up like, because, you know, really back then, in order to hear this, you had to have a mainframe computer. And when Schroeder was doing this, he would like process it all night, a mainframe computer, then put it onto the data tape and drive that 30 miles to where there is the one digital audio analog converter. And so to him, it sounded good. And then it was interesting that both Griesinger and Blesser built these boxes like, okay, we want to build something that can do reverb processing in real time. And they built it, and then they implemented the Schroeder, and they're like, this isn't that good. And then they end up creating algorithms that sounded better. So I guess my question is, how much was the state of the art pushed forward by and dictated by the hardware design? Like, how much of it was like, you know, were there limitations, or was it also like just basically that's kind of a vague question, but like how much of the hardware design was driven by the sound and how much of the sound was driven by the hardware? How's that vague?
Oh, yeah. Well, initially... Initially, like, you know, my challenges have always been with maximizing performance, maximizing reliability, all these things that go kind of the unsung hero stuff. But initially, early on, before the Sigma Deltas, you did have to do a lot of analog front-end analog processing, mainly with filters and things. Mm-hmm. And that was fairly challenging in essence. But the design actually was pretty much made easy by Thalen Key topology. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the term Thalen Key, but basically a very, very brilliant guy that did all this work where you can take a second-order filter, and he gave you with just the two resistors and two capacitors, you could come up with these coefficients that were all printed and labeled to come up with any filter function, just about any filter function you could think of, mainly all-pass Butterworth, Chebyshev.
Is this pure just resistors and capacitors, or is this like
with an op-amp? Okay. Yes, with an op-amp. Essentially, you would design around those, normalize them for what particular frequency that you wanted to use, and incorporate those. And there was always challenges in the layout, having analog processing so close to digital signals and high-speed buses and other things. There's a lot of science behind it. Like I said, there's a lot of rules of thumb, there's a lot of anecdotes, there's a lot of understanding. And it helps to have experience, and that's what you get. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. You're going to make mistakes. Usually you have a few iterations of board res before you can nail it. Really get every last dB out of it. But that was from my perspective, that was challenging early on, putting all that analog and digital and everything on one board, having power supply issues and trying to keep at least separated your digital and analog processing circuits as much as possible, which is difficult to do in a mixed signal.
Comment on the Thalen and Key. I struggled with that for years because we were doing, ninth order filters, and the Thalen and Key would never come out with really nice flat response. I don't know why it bothered me. It probably didn't matter for the reverb, as it turned out. But I was just bugged by the fact that, we'd end up with 1 or 2 dB ripples in production, at the high frequencies. And later I learned out the reason was, of course, is the op-amps just weren't fast enough for that bandwidth. I mean, the op-amp of choice in those days was the 741, and then later on the 5534, which was a bit better, all right. But still, they had limited bandwidth, and that affected the filter tuning. And so one of the filters, I played with the FDNR, the elliptical type, filters using op-amps, and those were much better because, like real LC filters, the sections actually talk back and forth to each other, and it kind of balanced out. So you could be a little sloppier on component tolerance and still end up with a pretty nice flat frequency response. So I did that. I even played with a thing called a Lerner filter, which is a phase linear filter. That was interesting. I never put anything in production, but I did play with it. And that was quite interesting, that you could do a linear phase filter. It was a form of an all-pass network. So,
what is this Thalen and Key you're talking about? Or whatever?
Thalen and Key is actually a kind of a, I'd hate to say cookbook, but it is kind of a cookbook approach to where you have a very specific topology where you have an op amp, you have two capacitors and two resistors, and they're just, you look at the topology and they're fed back in a certain way, and two R's and two C's. And what you do is with this topology, you take a choice of what kind of filter do you want. So you have a choice between a Butterworth, which is, flat, critically damped flat bandpass, but not very extremely good roll-off, and then you have a Chebyshev that has ripple on the pass band, but much sharper roll-off, and then you have a Bessel or an all-pass, a Bessel function or a linear phase that is very nice for audio qualities, but again, the roll-off isn't as tight as even the Butterworth. And you can make them high-pass or low-pass, and you can make notch filters, and you can make...
Any order you want. Second, third, fourth, whatever.
So before that, if you want to sit there and work out these second-order polynomials, kind of transfer functions, you can't. You can sit there, you can punch them out. The math is it's a little arduous at times, but what this did was it took, you didn't have to solve, which is certainly doable. I've you know, in those days with pencil and paper you had to do it, but transfer function, you have second order polynomials and a numerator and denominator, and even then the math, you get used to it, you can look at them and you can tell just by looking at it, is that a high pass, is that a low pass, is that a band pass, is that a notch, whatever. And incidentally, the roots that you find, are they real, are they complex or whatever, you can do a, what they call a bilateral transform and go into the a Z transform and actually transfer all that information from the analog world into the digital world, come up with coefficients for your multiply accumulators in your digital hardware. So they're very kind of a synonymous in a way. But what the Sal and Key did was it provided you just a bunch of numbers, capacitors, resistors. You normalize to 1 radian per second, so you put your frequency cutoff choice if you want, 1 kilohertz, 10 kilohertz, 20 kilohertz. And then you multiply and divide your capacitors and resistor numbers that they give you, and then come up with the capacitor and resistor values.
Was that a book or a chart?
Oh, it was a paper, actually,
that was done.
It? Yeah, IEEE paper.
Maybe a nice big table.
But just
order versus...
but just about any textbook is going to refer to that. And you can buy some filter books. I own a couple of them, actually. Where you open it up, it's just page after page of numbers.
Yeah. Was it AES paper? IEEE.
No, it was IEEE. And then there was Verif, was the book I had, the big book. But
yeah, it's
all kinds of filters, tables.
Page after page.
Tables of filters.
And
plug in the numbers.
And it's usually, and they're usually ratios, and you're usually better off standardizing on a ratio with capacitors like 2 to 1, 3 to 1. You got your 0.22 and 0.33 and 0.47, there's your basic. And then you use 1% resistors, and you could sit there and so you put in that. You punch it in, punch the numbers, and you come out with resistor values, and then you get to within the closest you possibly can. And they really work. I mean, it makes it much, much easier. In fact, other than some simple, hand calculator type multiplications and divisions, there's really no math involved.
Were the capacitors high enough precision to be able to work with that?
Well, capacitors are a funny thing. Very funny thing. And they're used for all kinds of different applications. So, if you directly relate to your performance, your application, everything else, and in audio, the audio world, I guess the dielectric material that you use is really key. And the polystyrene, I think, was the least leaky, the least drifty, the least, the smallest temperature coefficient, the most stable, but they all come with parasitics. So you have leads that are inductive, and you have a parallel resistance and various other things. But the polystyrene were the best caps. Problem was that they were very large for their value. Uh-huh. So you can get like 16 volt, 10 microfarad, or 16 volt, 100 microfarad cap, which you would only use aluminum electrolytic, which you'd only really want to use for non-critical applications. But again, I'm pretty small, certainly smaller than the tip of my finger, cylindrically, whatever, at 16 volts, and the more voltage, the better they get. So, 100 microfarad polystyrene would be as big as my head. They're just... So there's practical things involved. So, you really... it's a whole science in itself. They got guys called component engineers who live and eat and breathe this stuff.
A modern question about that. How does that translate to surface mount?
Well, surface mount, yeah. Well, you can still get film caps, surface mount film caps, that are pretty decent for audio work. In fact, that's what you probably want to use. There's polystyrene capacitors. You can get pretty decent size. But when you're working out your Sal and Key charts, if you want to get a smaller capacitor, you have to get a larger resistor. I mean, there's definitely an inverse relationship, and when you go through your chart, you pull these things out.
And that translates to noise.
Noise, right. Every resistor is...
higher impedance.
It's just the physics of it. And stability as well. You get above 10K, stability issues. But there's something called Johnson noise that you can't get around. And it's a funny little equation, the square root of 4KTRB. And what that does is it tells you just a resistor floating in space has certain amount of noise you just can't get around. And that's why when they spec a mixer, a console, they say, this is this noise floor with 150 ohm source. You have some kind of 150 ohm transducer.
Well, I was figuring if you get a big enough resistor, you could charge your batteries with it. But
well, no, that,
we just couldn't get enough noise out of them.
That actually defies the laws of physics. But to suck energy out of the resistor, right. You would have to drop the temperature around the space around it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But, the perpetual motion machine.
Yeah, know, right.
The quest for the perpetual motion.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, the surface mount, they do make film caps that work nice for audio. And then for coupling, low-frequency coupling, they still use electrolytics. Or you could use tantalums. Tantalums are a little persnickety in certain ways, too, but they're a little smaller.
Which ones blow up less over time?
Yeah.
The electrolytic.
Electrolytics blow up less.
Well, they will, yeah. We used to...
Boy, we're getting into some basic electronics here.
Electrolytics will blow up. They have a voltage rating on them, and they have a polarity rating.
Yeah.
They don't blow up. They release the factory-installed smoke.
Oh, no, we used to play tricks on each other. Back before there was human resources department, we would stick like a 10,000 microfarad, 25-volt cap in someone's bench. Before you power up your bench, we'd stick it right in the outlet, 120 volts. And they'd come in the morning with a cup of coffee and turn on the power to the bench and they'll
go, boom!
Now they'd walk you right to the HR department.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't do that. No.
So,
good times.
One question's not on here, but I know that Renee was talking about the ASIC stuff. And I know, so can you talk a little bit more about the ASIC at design and work at Alesis?
Well, Alesis, actually, when they first started out, like I said, they used discrete HC, high-speed CMOS devices for their designs. And then after that, when the later verbs, the MIDI verbs, and so on and so forth, they would use FPGAs, which are field programmable gate arrays. What you have is, you can still use them today. They're essentially what they are is customizable. Inside, what they'll have is what they call like logic elements. And essentially, they're made up of a few things. But you can configure any logic gate you want, delays, whatever you want, summers, filters, whatever you can, by using shift registers or whatever. And you can configure everything together. And you do that in one of three ways. You have, all three ways, you have two programming languages. One's VHDL, one's Verilog, and then the other way to do it is HSPICE, a variant of SPICE, which is a schematic capture way. If you're an analog person, you probably won't choose that because it's easier for you to visualize schematics than it is just row after row of programming. But you configure them, and then you can have them one-time programmable. And that the old we used to deal with a company called AMI, was in, I think, Colorado, was it, or something, Anyways, you'd have like 10,000 gates or, 1,000 gates for an FPGA, and you would configure them for to do basically all the reverb algorithms, the transformer algorithms. But you'd have to have connected to that. You'd have to have some kind of ALU and some memory. And you still have to have your external Sigma Delta or whatever ADC and DAC that you have as well. But what happened was when Keith Barr. I think he'd hired somebody, a contractor, to come into Alesis and do some custom ASICs. And he kind of looked over the guy's shoulder and was interested and kind of started designing his own custom ASICs himself. And he did them all in CMOS. Everything was CMOS. So he started doing the custom digital logic elements, and then he started using NMOS, which is basically, CMOS refers to complementary symmetry, so you have both P and NMOS, which refers to the type of material you have in the devices. But PMOS is slower than NMOS. So he would design amplifiers and analog type devices using strictly NMOS. But then the logic elements, he would use CMOS. So he started doing that custom, and when he did he took the crystal DAC and he built his own DAC, built his own ADC, he built his own he started building his own chips custom, and that's what went into the 8ADXC. Were very custom devices. He had a phase lock loop circuit and DACs and ADCs and everything inside, and basically got more and more integrated. But he would ship out to a fab house or a foundry his code and whatever, and would come back, chips and devices. So
come back in silicon.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
And that, like, that might be a segue to what you have here.
Oh, right, yeah. So this is the, you know, what happened was he split off from Elisa Studio Electronics with a group of guys, extremely talented guys. One of them is a friend of mine, Pete Selle, and he was one of his designers. And Pete Selle, Elisa's kind of, they went bankrupt and fell apart around 2000, 2001. Pete Selle left, I think, in 99. He went to Line 6 for a while, and then he, along with a few other guys...
Well, CELI, is that
yes.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
He started, originally it was called Damage Control, and then they changed the name to Strymon.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah. And then he started he now has a company, he's one of the co-founders of Strymon, and they make some really, really nice reverb and effects boxes specifically for guitar. You can go online... look up Strymon, and you see all kinds of videos where he's showing. So he has these really cool boxes. They sell $300 or so for
the small ones.
Box. Yeah, for the small ones.
Big ones like $500.
Yeah. So anyways, he left with Keith. He's worked with Keith at least this semiconductor, and he kind of learned a lot about ASICs. And then eventually, what they did, the group of guys that worked with Keith, Elisa Semiconductor, they changed the name to to Spin. And they came up with this little chip on here. I got this eval board. And this little chip right here basically is, it contains the DSP, which, the ALU and all that. It contains the DACs and the ADCs. It contains all the memory that you need. And everything in one chip. So it just evolved. So if you think about the XT1000 then came out in 85. It eventually, all that evolved onto one chip this size. And Chuck, do you use those? You use the Spin semiconductor? It's used a lot in amplifiers. It's used in some, small, Project Studio mixers.
Stomp boxes, a fair amount number use them.
Stomp boxes use them. It's pretty cool. I passed the book around that basically gives you, it has this very simple... kind of cryptic assembly language where you can program any kind of effects you could possibly dream of. And then it comes with some preset ones that you can play with. And this with a little mixer and a pair of headphones and a laptop. It's got a USB interface, and the IDE they send you with basically is free. You can download it. You can just go crazy with all kinds of cool effects. And I kind of... I'm a guitar player, so I kind of like doing that. I like generating stereo effects with mono input and doing a lot of cool stuff.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of memory does it have?
Oh, I forget the exact.
It's 32K words of delay memory.
Question. Mm-hmm. Question.
But that's like this weird. I think it's like a 14-bit data format, but it like the it's got enough memory on chip to store. Well, I guess a program at a time, but you can you load in each program is 128 instructions.
So the question was how much memory does it have? I guess to put it another way, does it have delay memory or do you have to use?
Yeah, no, that's it's got the 32K words of memory is delay memory.
I see.
And it's very similar because Renee was talking about, I think it was the MMU with the memory management unit.
Yeah.
A lot of these reverb devices would do something is basically what it is that when you have a delay line, that's how it explains. Like a delay line is like basically, simply a signal comes in, it comes out X amount of time later. And you had mentioned the bucket brigade delays where it's like, okay, you record something as a sample. Next clock cycle, it gets passed to the next bucket, next bucket, next bucket. That's kind of the shift register way, but in the programming world, in these algorithms worlds, usually you have like a read pointer, a write pointer, and a read pointer. And it's like they just kind of like, what you do is you just have the memory itself stays in the same place, and you just increment those pointers around each other in the circular buffer. And it's like when you get to the end of it, you have to wrap it around. Now, that's something that, as a plugin programmer, I have to do that. I have to just, like, I have to spend cycles. It's like add, increment the next buffer. And you have to check to make sure you're not running off the end of the buffer. Because if you run off the end of the buffer, the best that's going to happen is that it's going to sound like a strange delay. Maybe you'll get, like, too much delay. But things running off a buffer in a computer, that's where it's like, oh, it just made a strange popping noise. Oh, my DAW just shut down. It's like you can step on memory that you don't want to step on. So in hardware devices, like hardware reverbs, there's usually the memory management unit would implement something where it's like basically every sample, all the read and write pointers would be incremented. And usually it's like something's like when you say, yeah, it's like, you know, like you know, as I said, it's like this is a 32K memory. It's like they usually would be 16K, 32K, 64K, some power of two. So you can use some neat binary math to just like, we're just automatically like, you know, you're mapping your delay address to a fixed point number, and then you mask that so that, or mask it, you know, some sort of masking within the hardware itself so that every sample, your pointers were automatically incremented and you also had the wraparound happening. Now, what that meant is that there's certain algorithms that were harder to do. Like you couldn't just implement like, you know, like there had to be tricks to do some things that like, you know, sampling and stuff like that. You know, it's like you play it, it's like, it's a little bit more tricky with stuff like that. But so that's like something that like, you know, from the get-go, that was kind of a common thing you would see in hardware design.
That's why the MMU was so critical because it kept track of pointers. Write and read pointers, and basically it's just a series of three counters that are just counting along. Every sample, they count, you know, one, and then it just increments the address, one address, so that you can move through the memory. It's critical because that way you say the arithmetic dust doesn't have to think about where it's going to put the data or get the data. It's already right there.
And that's also part of the thing is like if you look at like the specs of some of these hardware designs, like hardware reverbs, it wouldn't make for a very good watch nowadays. I mean, it's like we're talking about maybe like a 6-12 megahertz processor. But what it was is that a lot of the stuff seemed to be done in hardware. So it's like, for example, this thing right here is 128 instructions per sample. That's not much, but you can run to an all-pass delay, which is a big building block of what we're talking about, takes two of those instructions. And modulation is like, in this case, they actually have these oscillators that are running on there. And like the oscillators are implemented in such a way that they're also deriving interpolation coefficients, which what you're doing to like interpolate delay to get chorusing that you know, for chorusing or moving the taps inside a reverb. And, you know, the memory, the counters are, you know, the pointers are being automatically incremented. It's a way of getting like one. You can read out a delay tap and scale it and add it to your accumulator in one sample. And that's something that you would see going back to the first reverb hardware. They would make this custom hardware that wasn't just a general purpose computer. And so that's why something that, you know, had really what seems like seemingly low specs, it's only been in the last several years that these can get anywhere close to that.
Dave, one of the things that Dave summarized in his 1989 paper, as he said, is that as of the state of the art in 1989, still the best bang for the buck, cost to performance ratio, was done with dedicated processors, such as Lexicon uses. There weren't any DSPs that could come near it for the price. You know, it's just.
And now today, it's like you're just kind of getting to the point where, I mean, you know, if you look at like a costing, it's like you might be able to run like 100 reverbs on this of similar complexity. But this is like a $2,500 computer. I mean, it's like, you know, computers are, so it's still expensive. Whereas like this thing right here is like that chip in single quantities is around $10. Again, it's like, it's getting to the point, it's like it's to, in order to compete with that for hardware, you're just now getting to the point where ARM processors are getting even close to that. And you still have to do a lot of work with ARMs to get there. And then, you know, DSPs are a great solution if you're working at a large company in volume and you can afford the development tools and you have a good connection with a distributor for the DSPs. Because unfortunately, these companies make their money from you know, car audio, military and stuff. The volume. And the audio customers are usually the ones where, like, you have to be like, oh, man, I really want to be able to give you more time. But that is, like, that is not what the pressure from above is telling us. At least at one company that I won't name, but I probably already did.
But you already did, yeah. a good company, nonetheless. Respected company.
It is a respected company. So this is a good... I'm trying to figure out which of these would be better here. That question... Or would you rather do this one? You pick it.
Well, that one's kind of fun.
Yeah, okay. Describe one thing that you worked on that you are really proud of, but you haven't talked about much, ever, or even tonight. Like, what's something that you've done that just, like... And it can be as deep as you want to get.
Well, it's not very deep at all. In fact, I saw that question and it brought to mind something I hadn't thought about for a while. But when I worked at Fender Musical Instruments. I don't know if you guys know the history of Fender. They started off with Leo Fender, then they were bought by CBS, and then a group of investors bought the name. I think they sold the name in 85. The name was sold to a group of investors that just wanted to use the name to make Japanese guitars, and which weren't bad.
They're pretty good, actually.
Yeah, you know, and just stick Fender on them and sell them at Guitar Center kind of thing, and everything was going to be, you know, offshore. But then the people were saying, you know, they really like Fender, and, you know, a lot of the blues players and various musicians were kind of saying, you know, we want some kind of custom this or that. So the powers that be decided, well, we'll open up a custom shop, you know, and we'll start making custom guitars. We'll get these luthiers and these guitar guys together, and, you know, we'll make just, you know, we'll take a loss on it, but we'll just do it for, you know, for PR. And so they needed a guy that knew electronics. And, you know, when I was a kid, I started off doing Craig Anterton type of guitar player magazine stuff. You know, every month they used to have some kind of effects and would build those things. I still have the first fuzz box I ever made using a 741. And, you know, so I thought, oh, this would be the perfect gig. And I had an in. I knew somebody that worked there. And I went and applied. And so I got the job. Working in the custom shop, and it seemed like, you know, hey, this is the dream job. This is where I'm going to be the rest of my life. But the thing is, it was in Corona, California, and it was mainly a wood shop and a factory. So they started making American guitar. They made the American Standard. It was made in the very late 80s. That's when I started working there. So they had this wood shop and paint booths and all this stuff. And it turns out that I was the only guy that knew electronics. They had another facility in Brea that they did the amplifiers, and that was about a 45-minute drive away. So whenever something would go wrong, whenever there was something electrical, he would call me to do something. And so I'd go like, oh, yeah, the power's out of the main, this and that. You're an electrical guy. Go figure. Surprised I didn't get killed. I almost got killed on the 43 phase, monkeying around with that stuff. But for a while there, the cool thing, about 50% of the job was working in the custom shop with the incredible luthiers, and I got to meet some very talented musicians. And one of the guys I met was this guy, Jerry Donahue, who's a Telecaster player for the Helicasters, pretty popular back in the early 90s. And he had the reputation of being real persnickety, real meticulous, real hard to please. And he wanted to get a Strat sound from a Telecaster. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Stratocaster sounds and the Telecaster sounds, but they're very different. He wanted to get it, but he didn't want to put another pickup. He didn't want to route out his telly and put a middle pickup in there. He basically wanted somebody to solve this problem for him. And he was saying, it can't be done. And my boss told me, I told him, well, I want to work on this with this guy. He's great. You know, he goes, no, you're not. I didn't hire you to placate this guy. If you want to work, work on your own time. So I used to go to his house on the weekends and sit there and work with them, and I trying to figure all the stuff, wiring up capacitors in series and trying to get some kind of a phasing difference, you know, that you would get from a Stratocaster, that kind of a, if you're familiar with the Strat, you have three pickups, you want to get that neck and middle pickup kind of scooped out, you know, kind of tone, you know, a very cool-sounding tone. And I said, why don't you do that with capacitors and change the phase and so on and so forth. And quite by accident, I ended up wiring the two pickups. The Tele only has two pickups. I wired them out of phase. he had a Strat pickup. He put a Strat pickup here and then a big bridge pickup. I accidentally wired him out of phase when I kept on trying different values of caps. And what that did was I put it 180 degrees out of phase, which would sound horrible in normal conditions, but then I had the series cap. And it kind of brought it back in. And I remember when I was working on that configuration, I used a multi-pole switch. They have a two-pole switch. I was using a four-pole switch. And I would work on it, give him the guitar, and he'd play it back and forth. But I remember just, I accidentally wired it up wrong, gave it to him, and he played it. He jumped up and goes, "That's it. You know, this is the sound I've been looking for." And I'm like, "Well, what did I do? What did I do?" You know. So I went and looked, and I realized, and I said, "Wow, this is what I did." So I, you know, with my paper, I wrote up a schematic, and so on. You know, basically just hand drew a schematic and told him about. Immediately understood, you know, once I looked at it, that what I had done was do some clever little phasing, and just happened by chance to get the right break frequencies, and it really got a nice tone. And that was really, I guess, kind of a highlight for me. And the funny thing is, it was a passive. It had nothing to do with any active circuitry or anything. It was totally passive, but it was a very musical kind of thing, and it really helped Jerry Donahue's career out. You can now find the Jerry Donahue Tele. It's a signature series Tele, and it has those
wired out of phase.
Yeah. Well, not completely. Not completely. There's a lead lag kind of thing with the capacitor, the inductors, the very inductors. So. Second-order thing, kind of a not very magical. It was a mistake that I was able to analyze after I had done it and understand what happened. But I guess that was a big-time thing that I really enjoyed doing. And it was a totally passive unit.
That's cool. Thank you. Nay?
Yeah, well, if I haven't talked about it much, it's probably... I probably don't remember it anymore, because one of the things with getting older is if you don't refresh the memory up here, it goes away. But I do remember something from back in the DBX days. We did a lot of experimenting, you know, like little side projects that never amounted to products. That was a nice thing that we could do there and often did. And one of the things I was working on was low noise preamplifiers. And one was a low noise preamp for a moving coil cartridge, because that's what I was using at the time. But I was really interested in junction FETs. And at that time, we had a wonderful array of junction FETs coming from Japan, also from this country. A lot of people were making JFETs. I guess they saw a great future for them. Unfortunately, there's no longer any. The future's gone, and you can't get really great JFETs anymore. But I always liked the characteristics of JFETs. They had more triode-like characteristics, and I always thought they sounded better. And they were just, some of them were just really quiet. We used some at DBX in the VCAs and RMS detectors. I think we were paying like 12 cents a piece for these things that had a couple of nanovolts per hertz noise, which is really good. But I was particularly interested in the big ones that got really low noise. And at that time, I met a guy who was interested. He was using our DBX noise reduction systems to make recordings. His name was Charles Fisher, and he had a little company there called Cambridge Records. And he did his recording with ribbon microphones that he made. And the ribbon microphones were very nice. They had tapered pole pieces and a tapered ribbon, and they sounded absolutely gorgeous. And he said the big challenge with the ribbon microphones was making a good step-up transformer, because the output's so low. He said, "I need like a 1 to 100 step-up transformer, and I can hardly find anybody that can build me a decent transformer." He said, "If we could somehow just amplify the signal with the low-noise device." And so I said, "Well, I'm interested." So I played around, and I made a little... complementary JFET, and I was measuring JFETs at that time. I had access to a lot of big JFETs, so I was measuring JFETs for noise figure, and I picked the quietest ones, an N and a P, and made a little complementary JFET amplifier, preamplifier, and that he put in inside the microphone, so he only needed a 1 to 10 step-up transformer, and then this little JFET preamp would amplify it some more and get it above the, you know, get it up sufficient, and the preamp had to have a decent noise figure. So So I thought that was really pretty interesting. And so anyway, he put it in the microphone and he said, "It sounds great." And he gave me a pair of the microphones, which I still have today. But he was famous for the Rachmaninoff turnabout recording that I think a lot of people know about. It's really a spectacular recording. And he just recorded it with two figure of eight ribbon microphones. I mean, it's just great sounding stuff. So I think that was something I was pretty proud of.
Thank you. How are we doing for time?
Yeah. I think we're 5 minutes.
You got any
about questions?
Yeah. I think.
Yeah.
What am I proud of?
You haven't talked about. That was the question.
Oh, I haven't talked about? Rescuing my career from pure desperation by basically it's like when I formed my company, because I couldn't get hired around here. There's just, this is not really it was not a big DSP company. And I like interviewed at I won't say, but they were a major computer operating system company in Redmond. I was able, like, I had the thing where it's like, hey, you get to go home early. Like, so I just like, which meant you're done. And so I basically, I started my company because I had nothing else. So I guess that like, that would be it. It's just like putting together these plugins that actually, got my wife out of her 80-hour-a-week job. But other than that, I mean, I'm trying to think if there's any technical things I'm really proud of. I'm sure there is. I mean, it's like, one of the things it's kind of something that's like, I can't really talk about it because it's like the next plugin. I'm really proud of it. But I am. It's like, I figured out some ways of like, there's some certain techniques of like, it's basically, like one thing I'll just be general is like, there's kind of like the we've talked about like, how do you get kind of an instant, or maybe, I don't know if we have talked about this, but we're talking about like, we're talking about halls versus plates and stuff like that. Was that something we were talking about here?
Well, I think that was sort of the opening. I don't know if I mentioned it, but the big thing was halls versus plates because, you know, Barry Blesser and EMT did the plate sound, the digital reverb, but Dave's objective was to do hall sounds. And it was a challenge for Dave to do plate sounds, you know. And it took him a while before he could make a plate sound that the studios liked. The real problem with plates, of course, is lots of early reflections, very early. And it builds up to a very high density quickly. And it's difficult to do. But
And that's something is like basically building up to a very high echo density quickly. Like you can do, like, cascading a whole bunch of all-pass delays will really get you a high echo density, but
it takes time.
And it's this weird kind of like, I don't know, like kind of this Gaussian effect happens that the more of them that you cascade, it's just kind of convolution. Like if you run something through, you know, convolve something, it's going to be basically the impulse responses get kind of multiplied. So if you have something, the attacks get softened. And so trying to get something with the high echo density while not having a soft attack is something that I've been working on. So that's something I'm proud of.
Wait, we all signed NDAs, that thing we signed and that thing.
Yeah.
So NDA, non-disclosure.
So I'm curious, how does it work having an NDA with yourself?
Really, what's good is just being surrounded by people that just don't care about the details. It's like, you know, basically what it comes down to is that, like, for the most part, what I think about all day, it's not terribly interesting to most people. I mean, like the results, I mean, there's people out there that like it, but most people are going to be like, no, don't really like want to know. It's like, oh, all pass delays? Uh-huh. Don't care. I know what that word is, but I just don't really want to hear about
it. Doesn't sound.
Yeah, or even just like, is it done? When is this going to be done?
No, go ahead.
I may have missed it, but can you tell us about your company and the plugins that you...
Oh, okay. So my company is Valhalla DSP. And I'm based out of Seattle, and I mostly do reverbs. And it's something that I started. You know, I started the company in 2010. That's when Self was first released. But it took like a year and a half to get it off the ground, where there's just nothing there. But I did do a reverb plugin for a company, Audio Damage, which is I don't know if anyone here knows it. If you're on Twitter, the founder and I just sit there and hassle each other now on Twitter. he basically, but it's, we have our fun. But so I, this company, I do plugins for all the major DAW formats. And I actually have like one little side branch. I actually released these reverb cartridges for this FB1 DSP that's running in a Eurorack module. Eurorack hardware. Cause I just decided like go for the biggest market in the world, which is reverbs running on Eurorack synthesizers. But, For the ZDSP.
Okay, cool.
I have a cartridge out for that, and I'm have another one that's coming out soon. So, and one the cartridge I'm coming out soon is like it's this what's called Shimmer, and it's like that's basically one of these things that just so, really is like Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois. Is it Lanois?
Lanois.
Thank you. These are words that I never say out loud. he came up with this trick where it's like they took like a 224 hall, ran it through an AMS pitch shifter, and then through a Lexicon Primetime, and then back in on itself. So you get this reverb that, as it decays away, is always shifting up in octaves, but really gradually. And so that's one of the things I was most proud about, is figuring out a way of doing that, but being kind of like doing that in one, just like, you know, in a convenient, easy-to-use package. But also making it something that there's some artifacts. If you do that from a, technically, it's like that works when you do it through a mixing board. If you try to just take like a hall algorithm and run it through a pitch shifter in like a DAW and feedback, you'd get some weird coloration artifacts. And so I figured out some ways of getting that to sound better in the digital domain. And then I figured out other ways of doing that. There's like this whole class of stuff for doing, you know, space music stuff, if that's what people want to do. So,
what source material do you use to test your reverbs?
Oh, that's a great question. I use like the clicks that Renee talked about, but just something super impulsive, and that's just a flaw. But I tend to be using a lot of like, you know, I've got synthesizers hooked up and stuff like that, but I tend to use a lot of the same audio files time and again, because it's like it's kind of like frog vision. Frogs, when they look up at something, they don't, after a couple of minutes, they no longer see anything except for what moves. Everything else fades out and they only see stuff that moves. And that's how, so now, like, I listen to these files, I only hear the differences. And the files, there's Tom's Diner acapella mix by Suzanne Vega, which everyone's like, it's because it's a very dry thing, except for when you've heard it for several thousand times, you start realizing, oh, there is a little bit of reverb in there. And I listen to Pink Moon a lot by Nick Drake, which is great because it's just a stereo mic recording, super dry, and it's got stereo stuff that if you run it through, like, it's really good for testing stereo reverbs because mono input reverbs will just destroy some of the qualities of it. So it's an easy way to kind of determine what you're balances. And then other than that, like, and I do that in the testing. And then when I'm doing kind of the final testing, I go over to this guy, Don Gunn's studio, which is really well tuned. And he's got material that we run through it and, you know, and then send it out to beta testers and they tell me that it's crashing. And then fix that. So.
Okay. Well, I think that is a good stopping point. Turn the mic. So, yeah, I think it's a good stopping point. I want to thank you guys for agreeing to do this.
Thank you.